This is a podcast recorded at CB Expo, Cannabis Business Expo and Conference, on September 16, 2023 in Dortmund, Germany. At the main stage, Paul Forfaro, Deepak Anand, Ricardo Gader, and Nick Kenny. Moderated by Lily Temperton. Discuss the following topic: tobacco and cannabis, intersecting journeys, shared lessons. Language, English. Enjoy your podcast listening.
Hi guys, thank you so much for joining and appreciate you all being at the last panel of the day and not out in the terrace. Joined by an amazing panel today with really deep experience of what we're talking about, which is the blurring lines between cannabis and tobacco. I'd love to let my panelists introduce themselves and their experience and why we're here today.
Sounds good. My name is Paul Forfaro. I'm currently the Vice President of Strategy for Village Farms International. That is a cannabis producer in Canada. Prior to that, my experience in the cannabis industry was the President and Chief Operating Officer of the Société Québécoise du Cannabis, which was the legal retailer of legal cannabis within the Canadian province of Quebec. And prior to that, I was working for British American Tobacco for about 12 years.
Amazing. Deepak?
Thanks. Thanks for having me, and thanks for being here. Deepak Anand, I am the principal at ASDA Consultancy Services. I've been around the industry for, over the last 10, 11 years. Worked very closely with the regulator in Canada to develop the medical cannabis policy framework, and then eventually the recreational cannabis policy framework. I've done quite a bit of work as well internationally with a number of international governments on cannabis policy and regulation, as well as on the business side, setting up businesses involved in the pharmaceutical and medical cannabis industry. So excited to be here.
Amazing. Ricardo?
Thank you, Lily, and thanks for joining us. So my name is Ricardo Gader. I'm a UK lawyer, have been a lawyer for 17 years. I'm a partner of a law firm called Lawrence Stevens, where I head up our Reg Solutions department, which cannabis sits in. I've been in the cannabis sector now and advising clients in the CBD and wellness and medicinal cannabis space now for circa 3.5 years. And so regulatory sort of developments as they happen and change across Europe is obviously a very hot topic for clients of mine that are always trying to penetrate new markets. So that's my experience in the sector.
Great. And I'm an independent strategic advisor specializing in highly regulated sectors. My background is also tobacco. I spent 10 years with Imperial Brands, predominantly in the US market. And then in the last couple of years working for them, I worked on their cannabis strategy, which translated to me now advising other big tobacco companies and those in highly regulated sectors like pharma and alcohol on how to navigate and penetrate and maybe invest.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nick. And just touching on my own experience working in both kind of the cannabis sector and then also with some of these mainstream tobacco and alcohol firms and people in outside of the cannabis sector, a lot of people are interested in cannabis, but a lot of people don't really understand it and they don't really know what the barriers are to what, and there's often a more skeptical view often of some of these bigger groups coming in, which is what we'd like to touch base on today. So starting on some regulatory sides, and then we're going to be taking a look at some of the opportunities for tobacco and cannabis to work together before closing on some of the tobacco investments, the strategies that have been made, and whether we expect to see any more kind of direct brand launches, etc., from the big tobacco firms. So getting started on the regulatory side, Paul, what do you think are some of the key learnings from sectors like alcohol and tobacco that can be integrated into the cannabis industry from a regulatory perspective? And also when it comes to problems like illegal trading, imitation products, etc.?
Sure. I think the first thing in terms of key learnings, looking at what can we learn from tobacco and alcohol and what can be brought in, it's the first realization that everybody has to admit, but I think sometimes people are reluctant to admit, cannabis is absolutely much closer to a copy and paste from tobacco than it is from alcohol. And I think a lot of people want it to be alcohol because they want the branding, they want the marketing, they want the lifestyle aspect of it, but it's not the case. And it doesn't matter if it's a medical market or it doesn't matter if it's a recreational market, essentially you have lawmakers, policymakers and regulators who are looking at a product that you roll and light on fire and say, this is combustible, so because it's combustible, we're gonna make it look like cigarettes, or we're gonna treat it like cigarettes. So I think there's not really much aspirations in terms of what we're hoping to be able to be brought in, because it's enforced on, this is the rules we have to be able to follow, and this is anything from packaging and marketing and communication, and we're restricted because we are so influenced by what's happening in tobacco and vice versa. I think from our point of view in terms of Village Farms, what we're trying to do the most is saying, what do tobacco companies do very well, and what can we be inspired by, and what can we bring into the way we run our business? And the two elements that we continually talk about is creativity and efficiency. If you are so regulated that you cannot talk about your brand and about your products, how do you find ways to be able to increase your sales? How do you be able to find ways that when a consumer walks into a store, they choose your product? How does a retailer recommend your product? So we get really excited about the creativity behind how other companies have done this, but also there's the efficiency component to, you have to do it well and you have to make it work. So anything from supply chain to logistics to procurement of product, we really, really like. We are obsessed with the notion of how tobacco companies do consumer and customer engagement and this whole B2B2C type model. We like the idea of engagement as well. And I'll be honest, coming from tobacco, it was always very difficult to engage with regulators because they didn't want to take meetings all the time. From cannabis, from personal experience, it's been much easier. And I think that when we start engaging with government, the one thing that our industry does not have is consolidated data. We don't have a Nielsen. We don't have the historical point of view in terms of using data to be able to build business cases. So when we have those meetings, we have to make sure we're prepared. So we invest a lot of time in getting data, point of sale data, to be able to have real-time data as much as possible. So whether we're working with a regulator or whether we're working with a provincial board, we have the most amount of data in the room to be able to convince them on where the white spaces are and what we can do. That helps us build brands. And as we're building brands that stand for aspects like quality, that stand for aspects like security, that makes it much easier to be able to compete with the illicit market.
100%. Thank you for the insights. And Ricardo, do you have anything to add on that from a regulatory side?
I do, in the sense that I understand where Paul's coming from with the tobacco industry, but we have to look historically at a few points here, because I can see where businesses like to align tobacco with cannabis, the two plants, but we have to look at the differentiations between cannabis and tobacco. Tobacco, sorry to say, it kills about 8 million people each year, more or less, give or take. And we're saying that cannabis is a good, it's a health. We've got medicinal and we've got the CBD and wellness sector. And then we have to learn from what tobacco did historically and to a certain extent continues to do on the illicit market, and disguising products that are not legal or pretending that they are legal, falsifying papers and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, and there's some horror stories within the cannabis space that I'm hearing from my medicinal clients, it's already starting to happen in the medicinal space, where patients who have been prescribed cannabis are starting to sell that. So they're illicitly selling something that they shouldn't be selling. Or they are taking what was the medicinal flower, let's say for argument's sake, taking it out of their prescriptive product and inserting an illicit cannabis plant in there. So they haven't learnt those, because that's already happened in the tobacco industry. So I think it's a very difficult scenario. If we had all the answers, and we're not the politicians, so we can't give you those answers now, but it's very difficult. And so we have to be very careful of trying to get an alignment with tobacco and cannabis, because in one sense we're saying, look, it's medicinal, and that might not be the play that tobacco companies want to. They might do, because fundamentally tobacco is decreasing in sales year on year, so they might want to have a positive note out there on, you know, a medicinal product. So we just have to be careful, because if we're going to take the cannabis industry forward, I think we've got to be careful with the illicit market. And, you know, the medicinal play, in my view, and many might disagree with me, is the first play that needs to really iron out, because then we can have an adult use market, because then we can differentiate what those products look like.
Can I just add something on the regulatory side? So just having been in the room with regulators over quite a while now, and being part of Canada being the first G7 country to have legalized cannabis, what I can say is regulators look at this very differently. And I think the industry at large should appreciate how regulators look at this. I've been in rooms where regulators have said, from our perspective, alcohol and tobacco have been failed public policies, if you will. If we were to redo this again, i.e. if we were to start to regulate alcohol today, and if we were to start to regulate tobacco today, based on everything we know, it would look very different. Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand the regulator is coming at it from that perspective, because they've already learned a lot of hard lessons, and they've had to constantly change and be on top of their game and then sort of rope the industry back. As with everything, it's much easier to sort of open the floodgates, much harder to kind of close them. And so the approach that the government of Canada took at the outset was to have a highly regulated industry on purpose, saying that over time we will ease restrictions. So I think that's a very important piece for people to keep in mind. And then I just want to touch based on a couple of comments that both Paul and Ricardo made. I think from the tobacco side, there's a great amount of efficiencies that can be learned. I mean, tobacco understands how to deal with regulation, and I think we can pull out from those, and that can be applied to the cannabis industry. I think the point Ricardo made is an important one. At the same time, cannabis and tobacco are quite different. It's not sort of a one-size-fits-all approach. And just because you've got a nicotine vape doesn't necessarily mean it's completely applicable to a cannabis vape. It's not entirely the same when you get into product formulation. So I think it's important for us to keep that in mind as well.
100%. Thank you, Deepak. And touching a bit more on your experience in Canada and Paul, perhaps from your experience at Village Farms, you could also share here. How do the kind of tax structures, when we consider tobacco versus cannabis and the various frameworks that are working. Given how much kind of tax has been crippling the cannabis markets in North America, the excise tax reform, etc., what can we learn from how tobacco has done it, and is that something we would want to emulate at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's a key word you used in your question, which was crippling. And the fact of the matter is today, excise and taxation is crippling the industry, right? If you look at it historically, so you had tobacco and alcohol, and Deepak, you were touching on this a little bit about their historical context, right? But you had tobacco and alcohol that were very popular, part of everyday culture and society, and incredibly profitable. And the government decided to tax it. Now, to be very honest, I don't think anybody's going to argue whether something should be taxed or shouldn't be taxed. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. We have to live with it. But a very, very profitable industry that was taxed. In Canada, when the taxation started to happen at an accelerated rate and excise started to happen at an accelerated rate in tobacco, a very profitable legal market created a very profitable illegal market. And what basically happened, and you have evidence and quantitative data on this, that shows when governments increase excise too quickly or by large amounts, illicit grows. When they hold it steady and kind of increases slowly over time, it can be controlled. And there are some examples of when excise tax on tobacco was repealed, and all of a sudden you see a shrinkage of the illicit market. So that exists. Again, it's a little bit of a copy and paste in terms of right now, they're applying a model where it's a very profitable illegal market that we're trying to migrate over into the legal market, but we're taxing it at such an extent that's making it very hard for producers to be able to compete, and more importantly, sometimes for consumers to be able to make the switch from an illicit market into a legal market. And I think right now, you know, in Canada, for everybody's context, it's very, very punitive. And a startup cannabis company does not have the same rearview mirror that tobacco and alcohol have. And because they don't have the same rearview mirror, which in other words is profitability and positive cash flow, the runway ahead of most companies is very, very short. So right now in Canada, it's either a dollar per gram or a percentage of sales, whichever is higher. So if you take a company like Village Farms, we're doing very well. Our sales we're big in the market. Our sales are good. So we're being charged more on excise because of how well our sales are doing. Okay, and right now, using rough numbers, for every dollar we generate, we're probably keeping about 27 cents to 30 cents based on everything that we're generating. If you look at it on a smaller competitor who might not be doing as well, who's struggling, well, essentially what's happening is they're still being punished because they have to pay the higher amount, which is the dollar per gram. So no matter what you do, you're kind of screwed, right? Or you're going to get punitive a little bit more. So I think really in terms of government and in terms of regulations, again, we know it is going to be taxed. We know governments will do that and they will bake it into their budgets. But what I would prescribe is it has to start low. it probably should have started lower than it actually is. It probably should have been way less punitive than it currently is. And the idea is it has to be reviewed. It has to be something, and this has to be collaboration between the industry and between lawmakers and policymakers in terms of how the industry can succeed in converting the illicit market, and the government can still tax it. But there has to be a happy medium between that.
For sure, that's so important. Deepak, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I just want to unpack the comparison actually between cannabis and alcohol and tobacco really in terms of taxation. So Paul touched on the dollar per gram. So just to unpack that further, if I'm a producer and I'm wholesaling product at $5 a gram, I'm giving $2.50 to the federal government just in excise tax. But that's not the end of it. Then I've got regulatory fees on top of that, which is 2.4% of my net income. And then there is a bunch of additional fees to provinces that go on above that. So really, you're left with very little. And it's a complete anomaly. In comparison, in Canada, for example, a 200 box of cigarettes is taxed at $1.35. for the 200 cigarettes. So that's quite an anomaly compared to the tobacco taxation policy. And I fully agree with Paul. I think it's got to be changed and it's got to be reviewed. And I think the government is cognizant of that. We are having a consultation at the moment on this in Canada. So I think that will change and certainly needs to change in order for the industry to thrive. How we got here, I think, is an important lesson for regulators as well. The way that the government of Canada came up with this was assuming a very high black market price. At the same time, what the government did was license over 1,000 cultivators. And what that resulted is in this mass supply, as a result, your cost per gram is needing to go down. And so that's, you know, the reason why that shift occurred in terms of where the government was versus where the industry is at today.
Fantastic. Thank you. And touching back on a topic which a lot of people have been asking about, I'm from London and a lot of us do stuff in the UK. And obviously the big news is disposable vapes could be banned in the UK. And it's not necessarily approved, but would love to ask Ricardo, especially as you're a regulatory lawyer in this field, what do you think kind of could happen here? And then perhaps Nick, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what it could mean for the UK and for the vape markets.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you when it's exactly going to happen because I'm not in Parliament to decide that decision. It's inevitable that single-use vapes are going to be banned either at the end of this year in the UK or at the beginning of next. And it does look like France and Germany are going to follow suit. And I think Ireland have said that they're looking into it, and Scotland and so on and so forth. We have to remember, though, that the regulations, and let's dissect this a little bit because we're in Germany. In Germany, there's a 0 milligram rule, so that includes everything, nicotine, CBD, and all the other herbal vape products. So it doesn't really matter if it's got nicotine. So if they go for a complete ban on single-use vapes, that would capture CBD vapes. If we look at the UK, we've got the tobacco and products regulations, and that really talks about e-cigarettes or any products with nicotine in it. Now, CBD doesn't have nicotine in it. So it could be possible that it really depends how they define this, because if they say all single-use disposable vapes, I don't know how they're going to impose that on CBD immediately, because there'd have to be a change in legislation of some sort to bring them in, unless the I'm talking about the UK, obviously, unless the Secretary of State, within his own powers, decides that it's going to encapsulate it. And then the BSI, which is the British Standards Institute, decides that actually that's the guide and that should be followed. So on that point, it could be that it won't impact CBD. However, as a lawyer, I would advise my clients generally that not to follow that grey area. Obviously, commercially, it's their decision. I'm not here to tell them how to run their business. I'm here just to tell them what the law is and help them guide on that and be their soundboard. But fundamentally, it could be okay for the first couple of months until someone says, actually, we're gonna throw all the others in to the same hat. However, I know working with some labs and some other clients, some of these single-use vapes probably could be adapted for recharging, but then that brings other issues into it. About refills and so on and so forth. But so it's definitely going to happen, but it might not impact the CBD vape industry immediately. But we don't know.
So it's a very hot topic. Lots of people have opinions on it. we have to, I think it's important to, first of all, to say that we don't know what the language will be, we don't know how it will be implemented, and we don't know the timing and the runway that companies will be given to pivot or re-engineer their product. I think, first of all, it's important to look at why it's being implemented. There are two reasons, fundamentally. One is the impact on the youth culture and underage use, and the other is the impact on the environment. There are solutions out there, rather than a straight ban, that could address both. One being banning or limiting flavors and colors to appeal to youth, as well as implementing a better enforcement on trading standards, so it's not sold to the youth culture. The other element is on the environment. South Africa, as an example, has a great, with BAT's views, has a bait recycling program where they drop pods back to the retailer and they get money off the next purchase. There are opportunities to look at other however, saying all that, it's likely that in most jurisdictions they will ban single-use devices. And to Ricardo's point, it's about the runway, the path that they've got to re-engineer the devices that they've got. The likelihood is, once the ban is given and we understand the timing, most companies in the nic space and nic vapes will re-engineer the devices or sell off their existing and bring in open systems, pod systems that are rechargeable and are not single use. On the CBD side, realistically, it's not a massive sector, and its growth is probably directly attributed to the growth in nic vapes. So it's an opportunity, potentially, if there is a loophole where CBD vapes are allowed to be, it's definitely an opportunity, albeit in a grey area. And if it's not, then they'll have timing to re-engineer the product and pivot. And that's the big thing in the vape space in general, is there's constant regulations, whether there's another one in Germany coming in 2026, which will affect the entire EU, about the batteries themselves. They have to be able to remove from the system. If that's the case, that requires re-engineering the whole device itself. So in answer to your question, CBD vapes, it's not a huge sector right now. For those within it, it will be a challenge, whether it's an opportunity to sell a lot of products in a short time frame or planning now to pivot and bring in open pod systems.
100%.
Can I just add one more point to that? And it goes back to something that we've early discussed and other panels have discussed. CBD being CBD, and we're not talking medicinal cannabis, there's not a lot of money or finances involved in this sector, and people always strap cash. And resources and distribution channels, I think gentlemen here have already discussed that. So if there was an element where they had to re-engineer their product, they might not have the abilities to do that in the CBD sector. It might be okay in tobacco, but it might not be a route to market for those CBD companies. So it's going to be a difficult, whichever way it happens, it's going to be difficult for those CBD and vape companies. I think they should need to speak to their, whoever, wherever they purchase their products, and to see how they can start looking into this. I'm sure, all the good businesses, they always look at the future, right? Surely they've already had those discussions, but that's the only thing I wanted to add to
Thank you. And touching a bit on a point that you just mentioned about how CBD vapes kind of fall outside of the tobacco product regulations in the UK, I think it's quite an interesting topic and maybe a bit controversial, but the topic of combining both nicotine and cannabis in a product, I mean, either in a wellness market or future recreational market, half of Europe smoke joints with tobacco. So do you think that there's ever going to be pathways for that, and how would that even work, and is that something we want to see?
The short answer is no, and the long answer is no. And this is my view. We have to... I was also in Parliament. I think Will was on one of the panels at the APPG and in London. And it's one of these things that, obviously, when we look at the cannabis industry, there's so many different sectors. We're talking medicine, we're talking CBD and wellness, we're talking adult use in some jurisdictions, we're talking about industrial hemp. There's so many things going on. And we can all complain within our sectors about, this should be happening to the legislator, the lawmakers. And I think we have to be laser-focused in our approach. And unfortunately, it means that some sectors are going to have to wait for one sector to progress. My view, and again, I mean, this is my view, it doesn't mean that it's the right view, is that the medicinal sector has to happen. And going back to one of my earlier points, yes, they're both plant-based product. I just can't see how we're going to change the law or regulations for both to coincide immediately. It could happen that in an ideal world, that where you've got a medicinal product line and an adult use market happening, that maybe there could be a product that could infuse the two where maybe there's no THC or there's CBD. I don't know. But I just don't see immediately that, you know, a dual consumption use would work, because it means developing both the tobacco regulations and the cannabis regulations, depending whether it's descheduled, whether it's not a narcotic anymore, whatever the case is, to see how it could underline. And then there's also, going back to the science, whether it's any safety issues. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to answer that question. But who knows? How does THC interact with nicotine? How does CBD interact with, you know, I think there's some studies out there by universities, but I'm not the one that should judge on those studies. But I think, and that's why I said the short and the long answer. I've waffled on a little bit, but the short and the long answer, in my view, is I can't see it happening for a very long time.
Yeah, I think it's a good example where the informal market doesn't necessarily transition into the legal market for that very reason of cannabis regulation therefore being absorbed into tobacco, because it would have to be at the same level, or if not creation of a new one. You know, it's interesting, obviously, in the European market we have joints where tobacco is infused with rolling paper and cannabis. In the US they have things with cigarillos, a number of brands, mass market cigars that use the wraps, and they use the flavors of the wrap to infuse the weed, and it also masks the cannabis itself, and that's been going on for a long, long time. But putting that into a regulatory situation, it's very challenging. If not, I don't know if anyone would want to. The only dual use I could see is the potential for nicotine combination with cannabis. But then again, there needs to be a lot more further work. One, to see if that's an opportunity, and two, to see if you really would want to do it to begin with. I think separating the two, I do think there's obviously there is still paraphernalia, which is the combination of both. A lot of tobacco companies have a lot of paraphernalia, both in, so there is dual use and dual purpose there, but in terms of tobacco itself and cannabis, it would be very difficult, and I'd question why you'd want to do it.
Good points. Thank you so much, guys. And diving back into some of the differences between how kind of the tobacco and alcohol and cannabis sectors work, we see with alcohol kind of surges of small-scale craft cultivation, kind of regional specialities, whereas tobacco, not necessarily as far into that. You're not really getting people sourcing based on the location it was grown or wherever. Paul, how do you, from Village Farms and your experience in Canada, how do you think cannabis sits between those? Is it more commodity, or are people really looking for kind of the craft as it plays out to a wider market?
I love this question, because you're starting to get into, you know, consumer segmentation, right? And you're starting to be able to figure out what a consumer's preference would be. I think, and I will always defend the notion and the idea that craft growers have to be given a chance, because they can do things uniquely, they can do things on a small scale or small batches, and they can hit some quality targets and some quality cues that many people are doing mass production cannot. Okay, so I think there's definitely a space for them, and I think we have to be able to encourage it. I'm also going to say I think there's lots of opportunities for local production. Okay, I'll be very honest. Growing up in Canada, you never really wanted, you know, you always wanted cannabis that was coming from British Columbia, or you wanted cannabis that was coming from Quebec. You never grew up saying, I want some Toronto weed. All the cannabis companies were based in Ontario and Toronto when it first started. So it was a little bit contradictory. So this idea of being able to preserve some historical context in terms of the illegal market, but to be able to bring that into a legal market and what that means in terms of the product and in terms of the craft, I think is very, very important. As a former retailer, where we were operating probably around 93 stores, dispensaries in the province of Quebec when I left, over 4 years, we did something in excess of 40 million transactions. Of those 40 million transactions, there was one thing that was really, really clear. What consumers were looking for was a product that was that had a certain quality, that had a consistent quality, that was always available and was very affordable. that is counterintuitive to the craft idea, right? Because essentially what people were looking for was, give me good bang for buck, give me a really, really good product, but at the best price possible. And that was the majority of the transactions that were taking place, and that's the majority of what consumers were looking for. However, and I think this is the other thing that's very, very key with the cannabis industry today, you can walk into a dispensary and every week discover an additional 20 strains that have just been launched. So I don't want to call it innovation, but I want to call it newness. And there is this amazing newness factor that exists in the market, or at least in Canada. There's this amazing discovery opportunity that consumers are able to go down, or this journey that they're able to go down to be able to try new things. And I think it's the combination of both that is going to win. You're going to have consumers who always want their go-to product that always has to be in their pocket or in their pantry or wherever they're hiding it, but to be able to have it. And then they're going to start supplementing that with other more unique, potentially more expensive, potentially more craft products to be able to play back and forth. And I think that's one of the greatest opportunities in the market right now.
100%.
I would just add to that, you asked sort of, you know, should it exist or not? And I think the famous last words were, let the market decide. And I think the market in Canada post 5 years has decided. And the market is favoring craft cannabis cultivators over mainstream cannabis, to the point where we've seen now bigger LPs buying up some craft operations. So I think from a numbers perspective, also, we're starting to see the market driving towards craft cannabis. That's something I would add.
100%. We've also seen that in the UK medical market. We started off with importing Tilray Aurora from Canada, and now you've got companies like Cantourage, etc., bringing in Miracle Valley and more kind of craft producers, and patients seem to be liking it more from what I've seen. Moving towards the investment landscape and looking at kind of big tobacco's investments and interests, Deepak, I'll maybe pass over to you again to start. What do you think about the current tobacco investments and how, what do they tell us about how they kind of view the sector at the minute?
Well, I think, you know, what we see is a lot of the companies have very different trajectories and very different views on this in terms of where they're going. Of course, we've seen the big deal, basically, Philip Morris looking at $650 million into Psyche. But I think it's important to unpack that and the story that it tells. So for background, you know, PMI invested $20 million into Psyche in 2016. But I think the big thing with this deal and this announcement was that the money doesn't get paid in, you know, all up front. $130 million goes towards, you know, sort of applying for FDA approval. And I think that really signals to you that the path that that company is most likely looking at is a pharmaceutical pathway, because the $130 million going towards an FDA approval is quite significant. And then the balance of the cash coming post-FDA approval, I think that certainly signals where that company seems to be going. I think if you look at some of the other players like BAT, it seems to be a bit of all over the place approach. You know, we saw the Organigram investment, of course. I think it's getting more intel on what's happening in the market. But then we saw the Charlotte's Web, you know, sort of investment as well, which it really tells you a story of sort of the differences between each company. And of course, Altria has done stuff with Cronos, and my colleagues will probably talk a little bit more about that. But it's really, we're seeing a different and diversified approach across the players. And I think a lot of it is, you know, in cannabis, we say, well, hindsight is everything is 2020. I think it also reflects kind of where tobacco has been on this and what they've sort of done. I think if you ask BAT if they should have done a few things, they probably would look at it very differently right now.
Yeah, I think just as the cannabis industry is evolving, so is tobacco thought on this. There was always the question whether you do early entry, first mover advantage, or whether you wait and see. And the benefit that most, that tobacco has, is they can afford to do both. They can do minority stakes, learn as they go, whether it's BAT with their incubator, PMI with a pharma approach, Imperial with Canadian investments. You know, that there is both, there are a lot of thoughts on this process, but we, as Deepak said, we can look with hindsight and say probably wasn't the right move. But at the time, 20, 60, 100 million to tobacco isn't a lot in the grand scheme of things, so they can afford to learn as they go. But I do think it's very interesting. I do agree with Deepak. PMI seems to be going on a pharma approach. BAT seem to be looking at pharma and wellness as a sector. I think Imperial have decided to refocus on tobacco for the moment. And then obviously the other big tobacco companies, if we exclude Altria with the Cronos investment, are looking at and waiting and seeing. However, what's important to preface is that there are other thoughts on this, which are, and there are restrictions as a tobacco company on where they're domiciled, what the regulation that they can actually deploy is. So even if they're interested, how they execute that investment and how they execute their strategy will really depend on the jurisdictions and where they're domiciled. And I think that has impacted many on how they invest. If there was some regulatory stability globally, I think maybe some of those investments would look different.
If I could just add something, I mean, I was upstairs looking at the vaping section at Intertobac, and you saw the view section. Mm. So I had the benefit back in 2008 as a very, 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 very junior associate to work on vaping. And back then it was called something else. And back then we weren't actually sure if we were going to get into the industry or not. And back then we were struggling with the identity of, but we're a tobacco company, we're not a nicotine company, and we'll never be a nicotine company. And you look at what Vuse is today. And, you know, the joke I think we used to tell ourselves on a bunch of different innovations within the tobacco industry is everything is a 15-year overnight success story, right? So we kind of forget about how long it took and how much investment it took and all the mistakes we could have made, all the mistakes we probably made, all the successes we had that were probably not as big as we wanted, and then all of a sudden it clicks. And I think there is something still interesting today within the tobacco industry is, even though it might take a long time, when that decision is made, they go in 100%. And you can see this on heat not burn, you can see this on vaping, you can see this on different oral tobacco and nicotine pouches, right? When that decision is made, the money, the influence, the backing just goes all in at the same time. And I've always been very impressed with that.
100%. And just to expand on something you mentioned of the heat not burn, a lot of times when I speak to people, they often think that would be kind of tobacco's big focuses, companies like PAX that are able to be used for kind of theoretically tobacco and cannabis. But when I kind of look at the investments, a lot more of it has been in more like vapes or nicotine, or it seems to be going in that way. Do you have any thoughts on why or whether heat not burn is going to be the thing with cannabis?
I have to be really honest. I agree with you 100%, but I don't have a good answer. It's one of those things where when you speak to consumers who are not vaping, but who are vaporizing a product or are heating a product, the fact that you can control your temperature, the fact that you can get different terpene profiles and different tastes out of it, the fact that you can modify it, it all makes sense, but I don't know. I don't know if anybody else on the panel has some insight.
I mean, not necessarily a heat not burn, but when you look at tobacco and you look at their core proposition, they're experts in inhalation devices. So as a synergistic industry, it's natural for them to, as a first step, to look at what they know. And that's normally the playbook, is when they've gone outside of their realm of expertise, it hasn't always been successful. So I think from that perspective, the extension of into areas where they're familiar with as a first start is probably the likely what they've prioritized. Saying that, I think tobacco is, as Ricardo mentioned earlier, it's in a necessity right now to diversify, to look at a third growth engine other than NGP and their core tobacco proposition. And looking at that and what that looks like, I'm often referred to as probably too realistic for my own good, maybe stretching the pessimism. But the positive here is that tobacco is very interested in this sector. They've made investments. They'll continue to make investments. So from a cannabis perspective, positioning yourself correctly and positioning your company to entertain that investment, it's possible.
Can I just add something to that? And it might sound like a weird synergy, but we've had this in other sectors before where there's a dying market. And we all carry a mobile phone, but 20 years ago we didn't. And there are big, big telecom communication companies that saw that coming. And they diversified very quickly into internet, into, you know, TV channels, into other things that, or even setting up mobile companies. And so obviously it's about finding your lineages. Where do I know a market? Where can I, you know, distribution channels? And that's why they're trying to bring in tobacco with cannabis, but it doesn't mean that it's always going to work.
For sure. And just another kind of question that often we get asked is, a lot of the big tobacco involvement has been through kind of either JVs or acquisitions, more on the M&A side. There hasn't really been many, apart from the BAT Views kind of launch, that's under their own brand or they've developed their own product. Is that something that you guys expect that we'll see more of? And do you think there's any reasons why they've chosen to keep a bit of distance from the product?
So there's risk. There's high levels of risk to leverage, and there's also the ability to leverage their existing brands, which are tobacco brands. So putting that on an extension, the only area where I see a possibility, two actually, is in vapes extensions. So a CBD subsidiary or in a stable market that's regulatory able, you could potentially have a Fuse extension in THC or a Blue extension or whatever. But you won't ever see a Marlboro edible or those. So the likely scenario for tobacco is to wait, see who exists and who are the top four players in cannabis in the future, what brands exist, and acquire. They can afford to wait, see, and pay a premium, and that's the likely scenario. I don't really see, apart from potentially vape extensions and maybe paper and paraphernalia extensions, I don't see them leveraging their core brands.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on that?
I think reputational risk is what it comes down to. It's still too new. It's still too unknown. Why bet or speculate on regulation on a state by state, market by market, country by country basis when you can just wait and see? I'll use another parallel, and I don't have any inside information on this, but I think it's an interesting one. When a lot of the Canadian provinces were talking about legalization, and it automatically went to the liquor boards for alcohol, a lot of them didn't want to touch it. And the reason why a lot of them didn't want to touch it, one was there was still a stigma obviously attached to it, but the second one was, well, it's gonna distract us from what we're actually trying to do. And new projects, new industries, when you're still speculating, can create a lot of excitement for very, very little return. And through that excitement, you can actually lose sight on what, the core business is and what you're trying to do, which can also hurt your returns. So there might be some combination of that in there as well.
The only other thing I would add is I think from a product risk and product safety perspective, I think there's, quite a bit of stigma still existing within sort of some of these companies. And there may be sort of hesitation from that perspective to put something out with cannabis in it. And then the next thing you know is somebody might get into some sort of a situation that could negatively affect you. So I think that plays very heavily into the minds of some of the bigger tobacco companies. But I also think that the safety of the product, right? I mean, we're still very new as an industry generally and as a product, and you don't necessarily want to put an unsafe product out on the market. I think, tobacco has learned the hard way where that's landed up. So I think there's that, there's a little bit of that scar tissue going on with them.
Yeah. I have to add, just because it made me think of it, I have to use Village Farms as an example. I mean, we're tiny, obviously, compared to a global tobacco company, and we operate in several jurisdictions, and we have to be very, very careful what we do in the U.S. because we're a publicly traded company on the NASDAQ, and even though cannabis is very legal in Canada, it's obviously not in the U.S. And I think that's something, too, when you have to manage all the different jurisdictions of the world, just because it's okay to do something in one place, what could be the knock-on effect and the domino effect that because you're doing it there, it ruins relationships, it ruins distribution channels, and it ruins performance in some other market, right? So I think that's something else that is probably talked about within the organizations.
And just one more to add to that, and it's true, it's all to do with the different laws and jurisdictions. So even if a tobacco company wanted to look into that, they would also have to think about proceeds of crime in the UK and how that would impact them and how they would have to segregate their funds and how their shareholders or their interested parties would get their dividends out. Because at the moment, if I'm in the UK, I can invest in a tobacco company with no issues. But if that tobacco company was involved in an adult use market, legal adult use market in that territory, it might cause issues for me then. Because that would be seen as proceeds of crime in the UK because it's not legal. So there's lots of different things, and I suspect I agree with my colleagues because they know the tobacco industry better than I. They can afford to wait. They can just wait and then buy at the right time.
For sure, 100%. Well, thank you for all the insights, everyone. I'm not sure if there's anyone from the audience who'd like to ask any questions while we've got the panelists here.
Yeah, hi there. Just a quick question on the lessons that could be applied from the tobacco industry on supply chain for cannabis today and where you think that might be heading and what kind of advantages the industry could be taking from lessons learned in tobacco.
Sure. I think right now, there's not too many tobacco companies that would claim to be farmers today. And I think there's a system, and the same goes with alcohol as well, right? And I think there's a very interesting system in terms of the way it's built to be able to procure raw material. In cannabis and a lot of different jurisdictions right now, you have to be vertically integrated, which means you have to be the farmer, you have to be the delivery person, you have to be the retailer, you have to be the brand specialist, you have to be the innovator, you have to be the lab to be able to test it in some instances. So it becomes really, really complicated when you look at that. So given the regulations in different jurisdictions, are there smarter ways for companies or more creative ways for companies to be able to take advantage of the laws, but in their favor? And we're starting to see that more and more. And we're also starting to see specialists starting to be able to pop up in different industries and different sectors, which weren't there at the onset of legalization in cannabis 5 years ago. So I think that's one element. The other one is just the distribution and the selling of it. I am quite honestly very jealous of the way BAT to this day still distributes their products in Canada, because it's a direct-to-store distribution model. So they are able actually to deliver the products across Canada. I think the turnaround time is still, they can service something like 25,000 stores in less than a week. That has a tremendous amount of opportunity in terms of how you're building relationships with wholesalers and retailers, because you have somebody coming in, a sales rep, to be able to engage and have a conversation and take an order, and then you have a delivery person. So now you have two points of contact with the retailer. When you start talking about how you own the relationship, and when you start talking about how if anything ever goes wrong, or if they need something, they pick up the phone and they call you right away, is something that I aspire to be able to develop in the cannabis industry as well. So I think, but again, everything from where you're getting your raw materials to how that raw material is being transformed, to how that material is being packaged, to how that material is being shipped, I think there's still a long way to go in cannabis. And you have to be very conscious of the fact as well that all the companies, regardless of what jurisdiction they're working in, are trying to replicate infrastructure of global multinationals, because you have to do all these things, but you're doing it in a startup industry. And you're doing it with maybe public funds or maybe personal funds that you're pumping in yourself. And you're trying to replicate this global kind of multinational business supply chain and infrastructure as you're barely making ends meet, and you know, you're losing 75 cents of every dollar you make to the government. So I think, but again, that is something with over time, I think will happen. And I also think, since we're talking about, you know, where tobacco companies can invest, this would be the first thing I would piggyback on if there was a tobacco investment.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming and for having us. And thank you to the whole audience for joining, and to the panelists.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can find more podcasts on our channel, and we look forward to welcoming you to one of our upcoming events. All dates are available at cb-net.com.